The official camouflage was almost as important to the military in 1947 as it was in 1961 when I took over. It was important because, as far as the army was concerned, 1947 was still wartime, a cold war, perhaps, but war nevertheless, and stories about military hardware as valuable as the material retrieved from Roswell could not be disclosed for fear that the Soviets would exploit it. Thus, from day one, the army treated its retrieval of the debris as if it were an operation conducted in a wartime theater under battle conditions. Roswell became military intelligence. General Twining had seen the material for himself, and even before he returned to Wright Field, he'd conferred with the rocket scientists who were part of his brain trust at Alamogordo. Now, during the remainder of the summer months, he quietly compiled a report that he would deliver to President Truman and an ad hoc group of military, government, and civilian officials, who would ultimately become the chief policy makers for what would become an ongoing contact with extraterrestrials over the ensuing 50 years. And as stories of the Roswell crash and other UFO sightings around US military bases began to filter in through the command chain of the armed services, General Twining also needed to establish a lower security channel along which he could exchange information with other commands that were not cleared all the way to the top. General Twining still reported to higher-ups who, though they may not have had the security clearance he had with regard to extraterrestrial contact, nevertheless were his commanding officers and routinely sought information from the AMC. Accordingly, General Twining needed to maintain a quasi-cover, up even within the military. The first of these reports was transmitted from General Twining to the Commanding General of Army Air Forces in Washington, dated September 23, 1947. Written to the attention of Brigadier General George Shulgin, Twining's memo addressed, in the most general of terms, the official Air Materiel Command's intelligence regarding flying discs. He drew a remarkable number of conclusions, most of which I had to surmise when I was on Eisenhower's National Security Council and then again when I got to the Pentagon, were based on Twining's own first-hand experience with the sighting reports from Roswell and other sighting reports, as well as the materials themselves, which were in the military's possession. Flying saucers or UFOs are not illusions, Twining says, referring to the sighting of strange objects in the sky as something real and not visionary or fictitious. Even though he cites the possibility that some of the sightings are only meteors or other natural occurrences, he says that the reports are based upon real sightings of actual objects approximating the shape of a disc, of such appreciable size as to be as large as man-made aircraft. Considering that this report was never intended for public scrutiny, especially in 1947, Twining marveled at the aircraft's operating characteristics and went on record, drawing major conclusions about the material he had and the reports he'd heard or read. But, when he wrote that the extreme maneuverability of the aircraft and their evasive actions when sighted or contacted by friendly aircraft and radar led him to believe that they were either manually, automatically, or remotely flown, he not only suggested a guided flight but imparted a hostile intent to their evasive maneuvers to avoid contact. His characterization of the aircraft's behavior revealed, even weeks after the physical encounter, that those officers in the military who were now running the YET-2B, codenamed Extraterrestrial Contact Project, already considered these objects and those entities who controlled them a military threat. He described the aircraft as it had been reported in the sightings. A light reflective or metallic surface. Absence of a trail except in those few instances when the object was operating under high performance conditions. 33. Circular or elliptical in shape, flat on bottom and domed on top. Flights in formation consisting of from 3 to 9 objects. And no sound except for those instances when a substantial rumbling roar was noted. The objects moved quickly for aircraft at that time, he noted to General Shulgin, at level flight speeds above 300 knots. Were the United States to build such an aircraft, especially one with a range of over 7,000 miles, the cost, commitment, administrative and development overhead, and drain on existing high-technology projects required that the entire project should be independent or outside of the normal weapons development bureaucracy. In other words, as I interpreted the memo, Twining was suggesting to the commander of the Army Air Force that were the Air Force, which would become a separate branch of the military by the following year, to attempt to exploit the technology that had quite literally dropped into its lap, it had to do so separately and independently from any normal weapons development program. The descriptions of the super-secret projects at Nellis Air Force Base or Area 51 in the Nevada desert seemed to fit the profile of the kind of recommendation that General Twining was making, especially the employment of the Skunk Works group at Lockheed in the development of the stealth fighter and B-2 bomber. Not revealing to the Army Air Force's command that Twining himself had been ordered to visit bases in New Mexico in the hours after the crash, the general advised his bosses that the military should consider whether the flying discs were of domestic origin, the product of some high-security project already developed by the United States outside of normal channels, or developed by a foreign power that has a form of propulsion, possibly nuclear, which is outside of our domestic knowledge. At the same time, weaving a cover story that takes him out of the loop of reporting any of these flying discs as a first-hand observer, Twining writes that there is a lack of physical evidence in the shape of crash-recovered exhibits which would undeniably prove the existence of these objects. But, even though General Twining has just written that there is no evidence, he nevertheless recommends to his superiors that Headquarters, Army Air Forces issue a directive assigning a priority, security classification and code name for a detailed study of this matter to include the preparation of complete sets of all available and pertinent data which will then be made available to the Army, Navy, Atomic Energy Commission, JRDB, the Air Force Scientific Advisory Group, NARCA, and the RAND and NAPA projects for comments and recommendations, with a preliminary report to be forwarded within 15 days of receipt of the data and a detailed report thereafter every 30 days as the investigation develops. A complete interchange of data should be effected. This was an important part of the memo, at least for me and my research into how the Army got the Roswell rile, because it accounted for the Army's dissemination of the Roswell materials and accompanying reports within only a couple of months after the materials' arrival at Wright Field. When General Twining suggested to his commanding officers at AF that all the military branches as well as existing government and civilian commissions needed to share this information, the dispersal of the materials was already underway. This is how the technology came into the possession of Army R&D. Finally, the general promised the Army Air Force's command that the Air Materiel Command would continue to investigate the phenomenon within its own resources in order to define its nature further, and it would route any more information it developed through channels. 3 days after the memo, on September 26, 1947, General Twining gave his report on the Roswell crash and its implications for the United States to President Truman and a short list of officials he convened to begin the management of this top, secret combination of inquiry, police development, and ops. This working group, which included Adm. Roscoe H. Hilenko Etter, Dr. Vannevar Bush, Secretary James Forrestal, General Hoyt Vandenberg, Dr. Detlef Bronck, Drive Jerome Hunsaker, Sidney W. Sewers, Gordon Gray, Dr. Donald Menzel, General Robert M. Montague, Drive Lloyd V. Berkner, and General Nathan Twining himself, became the nucleus for an ongoing 50-year operation that some people have called Majestic 12. At the Eisenhower White House, it was simply referred to as the Group, and in the days after Roswell it went into operation just as smoothly as slipping your new 1949 Buick with its Dynaflow automatic transmission into drive and pulling away from the curb. In this way General Twining had carefully 34. orchestrated a complete cover up of what had happened at Roswell as well as a full-scale, top secret military R&D operation to identify the nature of the phenomenon and assess its military threat to the United States. It was as elegant as it was effective. But the plan didn't stop with the creation of the working group. In fact, the operation very quickly developed into something far more sophisticated because General Twining's flying discs simply wouldn't go away. As more information on sightings and encounters came rolling in through every imaginable channel, from police officers taking reports from frightened civilians to airline pilots tracking strange objects in the sky, the group realized that they needed policies on how to handle what was turning into a mass media phenomenon. They needed a mechanism for processing the thousands of flying saucer reports that could be anything from a real crash or close encounter to a couple of bunks tossing a python into the air and snapping its picture with their Aunt Harriet's Kodak Brownie. The group also had to assess the threat from the Soviet Union and Iron Curtain countries, assuming of course that flying saucers weren't restricted to North America, and gather intelligence on what kinds of information our allies had on flying saucers as well. And it still had to process the Roswell technology and figure out how it could be used. So from the original group that developed a whole tree structure of loosely confederated committees and subgroups, sometimes complete organizations like the Air Force Project Blue Book, all kept separate by administrative firewalls so that there would be no information leakage, but all controlled from the top. With the initial and ongoing stories safely covered up, the plans for the long-term reverse engineering work on the Roswell technology could begin. But who would do it? Where would the material reside? And how could the camouflage of what the military was doing be maintained amidst the push for new weapons, competition with the Soviets, and the flying saucer mania that was sweeping the country in the late 1940s? General Twining had a plan for that, too. Just a little over a year after the initial group meetings at the White House, Air Force Intelligence, now that the Air Force had become a separate service, issued a December 1948 report, 100-203-79, called Analysis of Flying Object Incidents in the U.S. in which UFOs are never referred to as extraterrestrial objects but as elements of foreign technology, which is actually the subject of the report. The report, innocuous to most people because it doesn't say that flying saucers came from outer space, is actually one of the first indications showing how the camouflage plan was supposed to work over the ensuing years. The writers of the report had located within the existing military administrative structure the precise place where all research and development into the flying disc phenomenon could be pursued, not only under a veil of secrecy but in the very place where no one could be expected to look, the Foreign Technology Desk. Here, the materials could be deposited for safekeeping within the military while Army and Air Force brass decided what our existing industrial and research technology allowed them to do. The could he as weapons failed, secret experiments without fear of exposure, and, most importantly, an ongoing discussion of how the United States could develop this treasure trove of engineering information, all within the very structure where it was supposed to take place. Just don't call it extraterrestrial, call it foreign technology and throw it into the hopper with the rest of the mundane stuff the foreign technology officers were supposed to do. And that's how, 12 years later, the Roswell technology turned up in an old combination locked military file cabinet carted into my new Pentagon office by two of the biggest enlisted men I'd ever seen. Chapter 5. The Cover Up. The cover up while General Twining was flying back and forth from Ohio to New Mexico, on the other side of the world in Moscow, Chairman Joseph Stalin was furious. Red-faced and not even trying to hide the rage that erupted like an exploding volcano, Stalin held up a copy of the Roswell Daily Record for Tuesday, July 8, 1947, and threw it out onto the center of the table for any of the scientists in the room who could read English. Stalin didn't need an American newspaper to tell him what his NKVD agents on the ground at Alamogordo reported weeks before, that a U.S. Army retrieval team had pulled a crashed alien spacecraft out of the New Mexico desert and was already evaluating the valuable technology they'd recovered. 35. At first, when the Soviet intelligence bosses got the reports from their agents at the American bases, they were more than skeptical. They figured the stories were plants, false information to flush out the Soviet spies the Americans suspected had infiltrated their most secret bases. If the Soviet government reacted to the disinformation, the American counterintelligence agents would be able to determine the path of the story and isolate the spies. But when newspapers began reporting the crash, then covered it up with stories about weather balloons, the Soviets knew they had stumbled onto the real thing. So it was true, Stalin told the group, the Americans had actually gotten their own flying saucer. Now, he asked, what would they do with it? One of the chief designers of the Soviets' embryonic liquid, fuel, rocket program was at the meeting. He, like many of the Soviet engineers who'd read the German secret weapons files at the end of the war, knew exactly where the Americans should have been in their guided missile development program. What information his bosses in the Kremlin thought he still needed to know, they gave him from the reports they received from agents in the field. But nothing, nothing about the V-2 launches at White Sands, nothing about the new tracking radars that Alamogordo gave the scientists in the Soviet rocket program any indications the Americans were even an iota ahead of them in guided missiles until he heard the news of the Roswell crash. Both the Russian and American missile programs were based almost entirely upon the German weapons research spoils that the Allies were dividing up even before the end of the war. I was a first-hand participant in this, secreting out German weapons scientists through Italy after we occupied Rome as part of a secret operation codenamed Paperclip that began in 1944. With V-2 designers Wernher von Braun, Willy Ley, and others running experiments on the German missiles we brought back to the United States, the Army had successfully appropriated much of the German advanced weapons research and was carrying on experiments in New Mexico. The Soviets also got their own share of German technology through their own intelligence agents and local Communist Party cells in occupied countries. And what a technology it was! The Germans had developed a crescent-shaped jet-powered flying wing, jet-powered Messerschmitts that blazed by RP-51s as if they were standing still, and a U-boat launched V/V2 that, had the Germans been able to hide even a small flotilla off the American East Coast, could have bombed out much of heavily concentrated downtown Washington in a matter of hours. All they needed to buy was enough time to deploy their weapons and get their U-boats in position. And that was their strategy toward the end of 1944 when they turned around and counterattacked through Belgium in the dead of winter and pinned us down at the Battle of the Bulge. Break our advance on the ground, blast us out of the air with their new jets, bomb North American cities, and knock Britain out of the war. With their new weapons they could have fought us to a standstill and won a bitter truce. Both the Americans and the Soviets wanted to get their hands on those German weapons, especially the V-2s. Stalin didn't have to worry much about who held the advantage in German weaponry after the war. Both sides were about equal. But this flying saucer crash, that was a different matter, and it meant that in an instant the United States could have gained an enormous advantage in the Cold War weapons race that had begun only moments after the Germans surrendered. What might that advantage be? The Russian liquid fuel engineer wondered aloud. What could the Americans have retrieved from that crash? Soviet agents reported that the townspeople in Roswell had talked about little creatures at the crash site and a crescent-shaped aircraft that the army hauled away on trucks, but the stories had been quickly silenced by military counterintelligence. So any real intelligence on what the Americans might be developing would have to come from Soviet agents deep inside the US government. Stalin would order it. And, as if they were activated by an invisible switch, spies from one of the most efficient and ruthless intelligence machines in the world began homing in on the American military bases associated with the Roswell retrieval and the key American military and civilian personnel the Russians knew would have to be involved. The Americans might not have been the most efficient spy catchers in 1947, but Army counterintelligence had been put on alert even before the Soviets knew that a flying saucer had been retrieved. Starting from the central point at the nexus of sensitive New Mexico bases during the summer of 1947, CIC agents questioned anybody who seemed interested in learning about what happened in Roswell. Ask too many questions and knocking at your door would be a couple of plainclothes investigators who didn't need a search warrant to rummage through your things. So maybe the Army was a little overzealous about their interrogation procedures, but by early August it began producing results. By the time General Twining was writing his report to Army Air Forces Command in Washington, both Army and Navy intelligence commanders knew that the Soviets had a high-priority operation in place at military bases around there. 36. Country. Soviet agents were everywhere. Central Intelligence Group Director Admiral Oskar Hilenko Ettor, a member of President Truman's advisory group on UFOs, informed the President. A top-down counterintelligence operation had to be put in place immediately, he commended, or every plan the military had to evaluate what they retrieved from Roswell would be compromised. There were a million questions. Were these flying objects the prelude to something much bigger? Were they communicating with the Soviets? Were they allied with the Soviets? Were they probing our defenses for a planetary invasion? We had already assumed that the behavior of these aircraft was hostile, but what did they want? Meanwhile, other reports of civilian flying saucer sightings were turning up in newspapers and coming in through local police. Even airline pilots were seeing strange lights. There wasn't much time to act. A secret this big about flying saucers was bound to get out and cause untold panic among the civilian population unless an elaborate camouflage was established. And worse, we had to keep the Soviets away from this until we knew what we had. We needed a plan, and right away. Some have said it was Secretary of Defense James Forrestal's idea. Others said the whole scheme belonged to Central Intelligence Director Hilenko Ettor. I, frankly, don't know firsthand because when the plan was hatched I was sweating at the end of the summer at Fort Riley, still trying to shake out of my mind the image of that ghoulishly unearthly thing I'd seen floating in its container. But whoever said it first was saying the obvious, according to the people on Eisenhower's National Security Staff whom I worked with 6 years later. Maybe it was Forrestal after all who was the only person in the cabinet who could have spoken to Truman that bluntly just a little over 2 years after the man had inherited the office from F.D. Rand was already a very unpopular president. It's like this, I had heard President Truman was told. We're in a real pickle here. Nate Twining says he doesn't know what the hell this thing is except that if the Soviets get a hold of it, it'll change the shape of things to come for sure. You fellas going to write up some report for me? The president asked. General Twining says he'd rather do it as a briefing, sir, for the time being, Admiral Hilenko Ettor suggested. For your ears only. Then we have to have a working task group to manage this whole issue. Maybe the working group, whatever it was going to be called, would come up with a report analyzing the situation as soon as they reviewed what General Twining was putting under lock and key at Wright Field, but nobody wanted to speculate until they knew what was there. Maybe you should sit down with General Twining first, both Forrestal and Hilenko Ettor suggested. They knew that Harry Truman liked to get first-hand reports from people who had seen the situation with their own eyes. FDR was corporate and knew how to digest reports. He trusted his subordinates. But Truman was different. He knew how to run a haberdashery store. If a hat didn't fit, he'd have to go back to the factory to find out why. It was the same with General Twining, who'd been at the crash sites himself. If Truman wanted answers, he'd have to see it through the eyes of someone who'd been there. Does he know what these sobs are after? Truman asked, referring to the aliens in the crashed saucer. That's one of the questions we want to address, they said. How do you plan to do it? Forrestal and Hilenko Ettor explained that they wanted the president to hear what General Twining had to say and then convene a group of military, civilian, and intelligence personnel with strong old-school ties of trust for one another. In this way, whatever decisions they made wouldn't have to be memoed all over the place, thus risking the possibilities of leaks and tip-offs to the Soviets. We don't want the newspapers or radio people getting their hands on any of this either, they 37. told the president. Winchell would crucify me with this if he found out what we were doing, Truman was reported to have said at that meeting. Nobody in the know liked President Truman very much, and he could appreciate it. It's just like the Manhattan Project, Mr. President, Admiral Hilenko Ehtu reminded him. It was war. We couldn't tell anyone. This is war. Same thing. Then they explained that after they had convened a working group, they would task out the research of the technology while keeping it from the Soviets by machine already operating at full bore within the government. We hide it from the government itself, the secretary explained. Create a whole new level of security classification just for this, the Central Intelligence Director said. Any information we decide to release, even internally, we downgrade so the people getting the information never have the security clearance that allows them all the way to the top. The only way to hide it from the Russians is to hide it from ourselves. But the president was still thinking about the difficulties of keeping an operation this far reaching out of the news, especially when flying saucers had become one of the hottest new items to talk about. What was he supposed to say when people asked the government about the flying disc stories? He asked, pressing for details that still had to be established. How could they research these strange creatures without the news getting out? And how could they analyze the wealth of physical material Hilenko Ehtu had described to him without bringing people from outside government? President Truman simply didn't see how this government within a government camouflage idea could work without the whole thing spinning out of control. Despite Forrestal's assurances, the president remained skeptical. And there's one final point, Truman was said to have brought up to his Central Intelligence Group director and Secretary of Defense. It was a question so basic that its apparent naivete belied an ominous threat that it suggested was just over the horizon. Do we ever tell the American people what really happened? There was silence. Don't ask me how I know. My old friend and enemy from the KGB wouldn't tell me how he knew, and I didn't press him. But, accept it as fact from the only source that could know, just as I did back when I was told, that neither the Secretary of Defense nor the Director of Intelligence had considered a disclosure like this as even a remote possibility. Well, President Truman said. Do we? On November 7, 1944, the day FDR was elected to his fourth and final term, his chief advisor, Harry Hopkins, had described the new Vice President Harry Truman as a man who couldn't block a hat but who shouldn't be underestimated. And James Forrestal, the man to whom he was speaking at the time, now understood what he meant as the secretary sat across from the now President Harry Truman. This was a basic yes, no question, and although Forrestal and Hilenko Ehtu had a knee-jerk reflex answer, no, Forrestal quickly saw that it wasn't that easy. As wartime administrators, their first response was naturally to disclose nothing, abiding by the old saw that what the people don't know, they don't need to know. But President Truman, who had not come from a military background, had seen something neither Forrestal nor Hilenko Ehtu had seen. If these ships could evade our radar and land anywhere at will, what would stop them from landing in front of the White House or, for that matter, the Kremlin? Certainly not there. U.S. Army Air Force. So what do we say when they land? I'm told that Truman continued, and create more panic in the streets than if we disclosed what we think we know now? But we really don't know anything, the Director of Intelligence said. Not a thing until we analyze what we've retrieved. 38. But both the Secretary of Defense and Director of Intelligence agreed with President Truman that he was right to be skeptical, especially on his final point about disclosure. So can we postpone coming to any conclusions at least until after you've met with General Twining? Admiral Hilenko Ehtu asked. I think he'll provide some of the answers we're all looking for. While Admiral Ross Kirilenko et al. And James Forrestal were briefing President Truman on their plan for the working group, General Nathan P. Twining was completing his preliminary analysis of the reports and material sent to Wright Field.